Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 25th of October. The question of this hour, should colleges and universities adopt affirmative action policies based on socioeconomic status? A third path on affirmative action. Our guest this hour has written widely about this issue, and he writes in a recent piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education, drawing attention to an article in October by Supreme Court reporter Adam Lipdek in the New York Times entitled College Diversity Nears Its Last Stand. In the piece, Lipdek notes that experts think the U.S. Supreme Court will probably accept a challenge to racial affirmative action at the University of Texas at Austin. And the article furthermore suggests that if the court takes the case, there may be 5 votes to strike down racial preferences, bringing about the end of affirmative action at public universities. Our guest suggests that there is another path that we ought to consider, and he talks about it this hour in our program. Richard Kallenberg is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, where he writes about a variety of education issues. He has been called the intellectual father of the economic integration movement in K-12 schooling, and arguably the nation's chief proponent of class-based affirmative action in higher education admissions. He's also an authority on teachers' unions, private school vouchers, charter schools, turnaround school efforts, and inequality in higher education. He is the author of a number of books, including Tough Liberal, Albert Schenker and the Battles Over Schools, Unions, Race, and Democracy, All Together Now, Creating Middle-Class Schools Through Public School Choice, The Remedy, Class, Race, and Affirmative Action, and Broken Contract, a memoir of Harvard Law School. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Richard, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, well, my pleasure to be here.
Tell us first about this case that the Supreme Court may take up, University of Texas at Austin. What's that all about?
Well, the University of Texas at Austin was, between 1996 and 2003, forced by a lower court to use alternatives to race to achieve racial diversity. So they came up with a couple of avenues for creating diversity without using race. One was to automatically admit the top 10% in any high school, regardless of their SAT or ACT scores. And the other plan was to admit students who were socioeconomically disadvantaged, irrespective of their race. So for a number of years they did this. They created a fair amount of racial diversity without using race. But then in 2003, when the U.S. Supreme Court gave the green light for using race in admissions, Texas added race back into the equation. And that's what's being challenged by some white students who were denied admissions to the University of Texas at Austin. They say that reinserting the use of race is unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause.
And the Supreme Court is likely to take this up this session of the court?
Right. It's always difficult, of course, to predict exactly what the Supreme Court will do. But most legal observers think that the Supreme Court will take this case because the court is more conservative than it was in 2003. There are now 5 justices who are on record as being very skeptical of race-based affirmative action. So this case provides them an opportunity to change the direction of affirmative action in higher education. So many people think that they're not going to bypass this opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And what about the idea of racial diversity? Do we prize that now? Do we embrace that as something that colleges and universities should have?
Well, I think most people of goodwill across the political spectrum think that racial diversity is a positive thing in higher education, that when students come to the classroom with different life experiences, that enhances the discussion for everyone, and that as a matter of fairness, we'd like to see the leadership class in our society, which disproportionately comes from elite colleges and universities, to reflect the diversity of the nation. The problem is that while the goal is generally supported, American public is highly critical of the explicit use of race. They don't like the idea that race is an important factor in who gets ahead in society. And so that's the challenge here, is how to reach the goal of racial diversity in higher education while avoiding a legally problematic and politically unpopular means, that is the explicit use of race.
You are suggesting that we need to look at a third path, and that would be to admit more low-income and working-class students.
That's right. I mean, right now at our selective colleges and universities, there are almost no low-income and working-class students. The Century Foundation, where I work, published a study in 2004 which found that at the most selective 146 institutions in the country, which is about the top 10% of colleges and universities, that only 3% of students came from the most disadvantaged quarter of the population, and 74% came from the richest quarter of the population. So in other words, you are about 25 times as likely to run into a rich kid as a poor kid on the campuses of our nation's selective colleges and universities. And so, I mean, this is a tremendous imbalance that is far greater than the imbalance based on race. So I think on its own merits, it's important to include more low-income and working-class students. And now, given the legal impediments that are likely to arise for using race, it's also a good way to indirectly promote racial diversity, given the unfortunate overlap in our society between race and socioeconomic status.
So we would be assured if we allowed more low-income students to universities and to colleges that there would be racial diversity?
Well, the research suggests that there's no better way to get racial diversity than to use race per se. I mean, the kind of by definition, if you want 7.6% African American students, using race is clearly the most efficient way. But given the legal and political problems with using race, using socioeconomic status gets you most of the way there. So the study that I referenced earlier, the 2004 study from the Century Foundation, found that at these selective institutions, if you admitted students based on just grades and test scores, you'd end up with only 4% of the class being African American and Latino. Under race-based affirmative action, about 12% are currently African American or Latino, and using class or socioeconomic status, as the authors of this study defined it, would get you 10% Latino and African American representation. So, it didn't produce exactly as much diversity by race as using race or ethnicity did, but it gets you pretty far along the way. And furthermore, there are ways to kind of increase the racial dividend, if you will, of class-based affirmative action by using certain factors that will really reflect the differences between different racial groups on the economic front. So to give you one example, there is, of course, an income gap between African Americans and whites, but there is a much larger wealth gap, that is the accumulated assets that that people and families have minus their debts. And if you were to consider using wealth as a factor in admissions, which I think as a matter of fairness makes sense to do, you could increase the racial diversity even further beyond that that 10% that the Century Foundation study found.
Mm-hmm. Considering, Richard, where the economy is right now, and considering the fact that universities are probably delighted if somebody comes to them and says, hey, I've got, for some of these selective universities, $80,000, I'll pay you cash for my student to attend, versus having a student who comes from a really low-income family and has virtually no money to pay for college, or just a pittance to pay for college. How are you going to ensure that those who are on the lower end are going to be able to come up with the dough in some way to go to these colleges that cost so much money?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. I mean, the class-based affirmative action approach is more expensive than the race-based affirmative action approach, because what happens right now is universities are able to recruit large numbers of upper-middle-class students of color. So for at the most selective colleges, 86% of the African-American students are middle-class or upper-middle-class. So they've avoided this larger issue of addressing the economic piece. But I think as a nation, we have to prioritize our funding of financial aid in order to ensure that students from low-income and working-class families have access. I mean, we are missing out on a tremendous amount of talent from working-class and low-income students of all races right now, who have a lot to offer this country, and we simply haven't placed a priority on it. So there is no doubt that this would be more expensive than race-based affirmative action, but I think it's worth the investment.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Richard Cullenberg is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, writes about a number of education issues, and he has written extensively about this third path for affirmative action, adopting policies based on socioeconomic status, and we may not get as much racial diversity as we do with affirmative action programs that use race to achieve racial diversity. But if we looked at socioeconomic status, we could indeed achieve a good deal of racial diversity. What do you think? 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we will go to your phone calls. I do want to tell you that the second hour of our program will be speaking. This is a great book with the editor of Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. It's people you have heard about, certainly many, many, many columnists, wonderful columnists who write on war, politics, sports, humor, crime, local voices, hard times, farewells, and the pursuit of happiness. It's a great American art form read by millions every day and helped inspire the people who edited this book. It will be, it's a delightful book. So we'll speak with one of the editors, hour number two. We go to your phone calls now for our guest, and let's start with Hugh in Milwaukee. Hello, Hugh.
Hi, Kathleen. When the 1964 Civil Rights Act was being debated, many Southern Democrats opposed it, saying that it would lead to quotas. But Democrat Senator Hubert Humphrey, who was one of the big sponsors of the bill, replied by saying, and I quote, "There's nothing in the bill that will give any power to the commission, that is the EEOC, or to any court to require hiring, firing, or promotion of employees in order to meet a racial quota or to achieve a racial balance. In fact, the very opposite is true. Title VII is designed to encourage hiring on the basis of ability and qualifications, not race and religion. And I could give other quotes about the debate, but the purpose of reading that is that the Civil Rights Act of 64 was opposed to racial balance, opposed to what we would call diversity today. But we know what happened. The bill was passed, and then behind closed doors in the EEOC, Alfred Bloom Rosen and Sonia Pressman and the others pushed for, quote, affirmative action, i.e. quotas under different names. It didn't matter what the law said, because they changed it and turned it on its head into an anti-white male law. So you have constant institutionalized discrimination called affirmative action. Now, you're going to talk about revising it under economic circumstances and make economics the thing. But the people who are in power in these agencies and the Department of Justice under Obama, why, they won't even enforce the Voting Rights Act to protect whites voting.
All right. Let's get a response. Richard.
Well, I think the caller represents a certain segment of the public that is quite upset about race-based affirmative action. And I think that those of us who care about racial and ethnic diversity need to understand that view and to come up with alternatives that will honor the original idea behind the Civil Rights Act, which was that we ought to make decisions without regard to race, and at the same time address our terrible legacy of discrimination in this country. And if you go back to what Martin Luther King was arguing for in the late 1960s, when this issue of affirmative action was starting to come up, he suggested not that the affirmative action be based on race, because he saw the tension between that and the original colorblind notion of the civil rights movement. But he did want to address our history and suggested a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged. And this has far more public support than the race-based approach. If you look at public opinion polling, there's essentially 2-to-1 opposition to using race in the college admissions context, which is where I focused, and 2-to-1 support for the idea of giving a leg up to economically disadvantaged students, a disproportionate share of whom will be students of color.
Can you, I must stay up front here, and I've said it before, that when I started in radio many, many, many years ago, I was in affirmative action hiring. I never would have had a job if they hadn't, it affected gender as well as race in those years, and they needed women on the radio if they had federal contracts in any way. Do you think that we have reached a point now? Well, first of all, let me ask you if that program has been successful. Were there a number of people who entered fields that they normally wouldn't, just because of history, have been thought of as a candidate because companies were forced to hire people who were somewhat different? Has that been successful, and has mission been accomplished there?
Well, I don't think mission's been accomplished. I mean, there are still imbalances both by race and gender, and in lots of different areas of life. And I think we have to be conscious of those differences and figure out ways to address them. But there are different kinds of affirmative action, and the type of affirmative action where special efforts are made to ensure that people from different backgrounds are considered in the application pool, and where there are efforts to recruit people who are underrepresented. That type of affirmative action receives far less opposition than the kind of the hard preferential treatment, you know, in the college right. admissions context where I focus, you know, adding, you know, 200 or 300 SAT points to someone's scores. I mean that's where people get quite upset. And in the college admissions context, interestingly enough, on the gender question, it's really now flipped so that a number of colleges and universities are essentially providing affirmative action for men because the male applicants are not as academically competitive on average as the female applicants. So I think we have to be cognizant of imbalances in the society and try to address them, but the kind of the hard affirmative action which sets aside seats at a university or which sets aside in particular employment opportunities are increasingly hard to justify, both legally and politically.
Richard Kahlenberg, thanks to you for your call as our guest, and we'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go next to Jan in Gurnee, Illinois. Okay, Jan. Hi, Jan. Jan, are you there? We go to Wade in Toma. Hi, Wade.
Hi. My comment would be is why isn't it that the applications for colleges or even jobs are listed with a numeric number at the top without sex, without race, and then based on a test taken for each one of those particular items, like if for college, if they're taking an ACT test, a number would be assessed to their particular test, and that would be the application. And even in job placement, the only other things would be physical limitations. Would you have, if the young lady that applies for a particular job is in construction and she's carrying concrete blocks every day, well, if she's 6'2" and 185 pounds and muscular, that's one thing. But if she's 5'1" and applies for the job and weighs 90 pounds, she's not going to carry very many and she sure isn't going to hold up very long. But the numerical question is I've taken state tests get into jobs and did not qualify because I'm a white male. My question is did it make that person in that job better because they were female or because they were African American or they were from the Asian American or Mexican American? Does it make any difference in that particular job if at all? I mean, if you're looking for role models, I mean, we have senators in the federal government that are African Americans that have said that they got the start in their education just by simply going to the library and having the drive to get there. If they were not part of affirmative action, they were not part of those things to get into college, they made sure that they tested high enough to get in. If we give the open door to them and they don't graduate, then we're wasting our money and we're wasting our time.
Richard.
Yeah, well, I think the, no university admit students simply based on test scores because they recognize there's more to an applicant than simply how they do on one standardized test on a particular Saturday. But having said that, even if one were to take the approach that test scores should be the most important factor, there are there are mountains of evidence to suggest that students who come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds are facing extra obstacles such that their test score doesn't reflect their true potential in life. So we commissioned a study which was released last year, which found that the most socioeconomically disadvantaged student, someone who had access to lousy schools, who grew up in a single-parent family, whose parent did not have access to, achieve high levels of education, etc., that those students are expected to score 399 points lower on the SAT than the most advantaged student, someone whose father is a doctor, who has two parents, who went to fancy private schools and the rest. And so the point here is not to ignore test scores, but rather to suggest that a student who has overcome obstacles and done pretty well on the standard academic criteria probably has even more potential than a student who has been given all sorts of advantages in life and scores a little bit higher. So the notion here is that if you want to be truly meritocratic, you consider not only the academic record, but also the obstacles that someone has had to overcome. And today, the research suggests those obstacles are primarily socioeconomic as opposed to racial. The race element hasn't disappeared. In the study, on average, when you control for other factors, African Americans were expected to score 56 points lower than white students. But the socioeconomic obstacles were about seven times greater than the racial obstacles. And so the notion here is to kind of identify and reward what we call strivers, the students who are talented and hardworking and do better than expected given the obstacles they face, because they probably have more potential in the long run than the more advantaged student who's kind of slid by in life.
And in the admissions process as it is, do those who are making the decisions about whom to admit to the colleges or universities take that into consideration? Are they already looking at strong, economically disadvantaged students because they think that they should be at the university?
Right. Well, every university will say that they do this, but the evidence suggests that they don't. So William Bowen, who's the former president of Princeton University, did a detailed study of selective institutions and found that there was a substantial bump up for underrepresented minorities, that is, African Americans or Latino students or Native Americans, but essentially no consideration of whether a student comes from a low income family or a family which is the first generation to attend college. So the Bowen study found you had a 28 percentage point increase in your chances of admissions if you were from an underrepresented minority group. So let's say based on your academic record, you had a 30% chance of admissions. Now it's bumped up to a 58% chance of admissions. But based on income, you were essentially no better or no worse off coming from a low-income or working-class family. And as I suggested, the evidence today is that the socioeconomic obstacles are far greater than the racial obstacles. Mm-hmm. So the universities are kind of doing the opposite of what, in my view, they should be doing. They're giving a great weight to race, very little or no weight to socioeconomic status, when the evidence suggests they should be considering socioeconomic status primarily.
And if things keep going the way they're going, pretty soon we're going to have a whole lot of economically disadvantaged students, aren't we?
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, the number of students who are facing these extra obstacles are increasing every day as the poverty rate and the unemployment rate for their parents continues to be high.
Jerry on the road. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
My first point is that the author, in response to an earlier caller, more or less marginalized the caller's comment by suggesting that he was in some sort of subgroup within the country, which minimized his point quite effectively. My second point has to do with affirmative action based on anything, is counterproductive in terms of our society. It creates and facilitates this entitlement attitude in society. And people need to get up off their backside, and if they want to succeed in this country, you can. It's called opportunity, and that opportunity is present for everyone.
Okay, thank you very much, Jerry, for your call. I don't think we would have even had programs like affirmative action or be talking about economically disadvantaged backgrounds if there were equal opportunity for everybody. I mean, isn't that the point here, Richard?
Yeah, I think that's right. If we provided genuine equal opportunity to students, if all schools, public schools, were essentially of the same quality, if all students came from families that were equally supportive of academic achievement, then we wouldn't need affirmative action of any kind, race or class-based affirmative action. But the reality is that there are enormous weights that some students have to carry with them. No one picks their parents, and yet students, through no fault of their own, are often found in very difficult circumstances and end up in terrible schools. And when we find students who manage through very hard work and talent to beat the odds and do much better than we'd expect, we ought to treasure those students and give them a little leg up in making sure that they are going to be able to take their potential as far as they can. So that's my view of this issue. The other point is, with respect to the first caller, I wasn't seeking to marginalize him, and in fact, I think the opponents of racial affirmative action represent a majority in the country. I mean, as I suggested, by 2-1, there is opposition to race, and so I think that those of us who consider themselves progressives have to recognize that reality and come up with some alternatives to the current program that will satisfy a broad cross-section of Americans and also deal with the very real legal realities that the Supreme Court is likely to take up soon.
Mm-hmm. Email from Suzelle in Wauwatosa. When I hear the phrase blindly based on race, when we're talking about the admissions process, I wonder if the racist rhetoric of conservatives is coming into play here. I doubt that admissions officials at universities consider students on nothing but race. This can't be true, can it, that race is the only criteria used? I thought that race was considered as one of the factors in university admissions, and rightfully so, given the historic nature of prejudice, discrimination, and the ongoing processes of oppression and marginalization in this country.
Well, I think that's a great question, and I'm glad it was raised. The issue, of course, is whether race should be a factor in admissions. In no case do I know of a university which admits students solely because of their race, irrespective of their academic record. That wouldn't do the student admitted any good, or the university, if that were the case. So we're talking about students for whom race is a factor in admissions, but that's still controversial. Obviously the original goal of the civil rights movement was to reduce the reliance on race in deciding who gets ahead in society. Having race as a factor is problematic, clearly in the context of anti-black or Latino racism. So we wouldn't say that a cab driver who bypasses a black rider is justified because race was just one of many factors he considered. He considered, well, he looked at whether the person was male or female, how he was dressed, his race. You know, being one of many factors doesn't take away the sting of anti-black racism. And likewise, I can understand the view of many Americans that they, even when race is used more affirmatively to be inclusive of groups that are have previously been excluded, that there is something jarring to many people about even using race as a factor.
Yeah, I'm hearing it this morning, no doubt about it.
Yes.
Right. Let's go to Andre in Green Bay. Hi, Andre.
How you doing this morning, Kathleen?
All right, Andre, how are you?
Oh, not too bad. I have a question, kind of based comment. I just want to know if the expert knows what are the numbers of African Americans at historically black universities that are suing over affirmative action about white students wanting to go to their college. You never hear about that unless it's an African American or a minority that gets a scholarship to a historically white college or predominantly white college. Is the only time that affirmative action comes up, or the only time that people start screaming and hollering about you're letting in too many minorities because these white kids are not getting scholarships to go to school. But you don't hear.
All right, your phone cut out there, but we got the gist. Richard.
Mm-hmm. So I take it the question is whether there are lawsuits from white students who are trying to go to historically black colleges.
I think that's the gist of it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of instances where that's happened. I mean, it's clearly the civil rights law has been interpreted to apply to all people. That is, there have been cases where, and not simply affirmative action cases where there are instances where an African-American employer discriminates against a white applicant, and that is just as illegal under the civil rights laws as the opposite.
And thank you for your call, Andre. We go next to Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I was fortunate to go to one of the top Eastern universities. And what I think, again, we're focused on here is the donut hole and not the donut. What is being kept out of this discussion is all that these universities, like mine, are top international universities. They get people from all over the world. And right now, the people coming from outside the United States have one thing in common. They're all well-heeled, whether they're backed by their governments or whether, in fact, they're wealthy. They show up fully paid for without the need for scholarship. And so the fact is that at this stage of the game, and I'm close enough to school to see this, that all of the kids in the United States are now up, like we are in the world in general, up against this international competition for seats at the top universities. And so this, you know, we can be sitting here infighting among ourselves into this, that, and so on. But the real problem developing up, again, is the increasing international dominance of students at the top universities in the United States.
Richard.
Well, I think that the caller has a point with respect to some particular programs. I mean, there are engineering programs in which a majority of the students are international. But the larger picture of higher education in the United States is one in which the vast majority of students are U.S. citizens. And so it's not as if those students are being squeezed out by international competition. And And on a related point, I mean, the American higher education system continues to be regarded as among the best in the entire world. When they do rankings of top universities worldwide, the U.S. Invariably dominates, and these are institutions which continue to educate a vast majority of students who are American. I think at our K through 12 level, we need to be much more concerned about international competition, given the next generation of students coming through.
Andy, thanks very much for the call. We're welcoming phone calls, and our number we have online open is 800-486-8655. Should colleges and universities adopt affirmative action policies based on socioeconomic status, with the Supreme Court perhaps deciding on the future of affirmative action based on race by June of this year? Do we need to, in higher education, to make sure that people from all walks of life are highly educated, look at income? And that's the question of this hour. Richard Collenberg has written extensively about this. He is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, has been called the intellectual father of the economic integration movement. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, you may want to think about some wonderful columns that you've read in your lifetime. The editor of Deadline Artists, America's greatest newspaper columns, John Avlon, will be joining us. Back to phone calls, and let us go next to Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was listening to most of it. I missed the first 10 minutes or so, so I hope I don't repeat anything that's been called in. But it just seems to me like this whole conversation defies logic, in that I would think that if you want your country to get ahead, that you want to go strictly on merit. The best students get in first, the worst students get in last. And that's regardless of anything else. And if someone comes from a poor, lower economic strata, well, then they get more help as far as their tuition and room and board and so forth. But to just say, whether it's race or whether it's economic conditions, don't we want the very best students to go to school and support this economy? It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I completely agree that we want the very best students at our top universities and colleges. And that's precisely why I think we have to take into account what sort of obstacles a student has overcome. And this, by the way, is a view that is shared not only by liberals, but by many conservatives. So on the Supreme Court, Justice Antonin Scalia, Justice Clarence Thomas have problems with using race, but they've both said if a student has faced special problems, that ought to be part of the consideration, that if we want to be truly meritocratic, that it would be wrong to ignore the fact that some students have received all sorts of advantages in order to build their academic record, whereas some students have managed to do well despite all these extra obstacles. So what I'm trying to suggest here is a system that is more meritocratic than simply looking at grades and test scores, because it looks at grades and test scores in the context of what sort of obstacles a student has had to face.
Thanks, Ralph, for the call. An email from Elizabeth in Milwaukee. Is there any data on student adjustment, happiness, or retention for students admitted to universities with a boost from affirmative action?
Yes, there are data on this question at the University of UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. There's a professor by the name of Rick Sander who has looked at how students do when admitted by race-based affirmative action. And he finds, particularly at the law school level, that there are some major problems that develop, that if the size of the preference is too large, that you have a lot of students who are admitted to law schools, and then even if they manage to graduate, they then don't pass the bar at the bar exam at very high rates. And so that's not to suggest that affirmative action universally ends up admitting underprepared students, but that the size of the preference matters. And when you reach too deep down into the pool, that there can be some problems created.
Mm-hmm. David in Brookfield, hi.
I teach at a college, and I'm all for what he's saying. I think it's wonderful, and our school embraces the idea of giving advantage to students. The problem I see, though, is once they get in, if you don't give them remedial training, if you don't give them a lower course load, if you don't give them more time to get the – many of these students, sadly, are gone within a year because they don't have the study skills. They just simply don't have the background to compete once they get in.
Well, that's right, and the as I mentioned earlier, no one benefits, neither the university nor the individual student, if they are admitted with a preference that is large and leaves them completely unprepared. So, but there is some evidence that selective colleges, which are the ones where the affirmative action issue comes into play, have additional resources that allow students to succeed. There was a study that William Bowen, who I mentioned earlier, the former president of Princeton University, did, which suggested that students who are given a modest preference in admissions will do well if they receive that additional support that selective institutions tend to have the wherewithal to provide. So that's an important piece of this conversation, that we want students who show promise and have overcome obstacles but haven't had such a difficult K through 12 schooling environment that they'll be completely unprepared to do well. I just mentioned one other thing quickly. The study that I mentioned earlier, the 2004 Century Foundation study, found that you could increase the number of the proportion of students coming from the bottom socioeconomic half from 10% to 38% and still have graduation rates at the same level as you currently do. So that is to say there is some low-hanging fruit. Low-income students who are academically talented, who could do well at even the most selective institutions, but who are not now going.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've got the whole issue which we need to talk to you at length about later, and that's making sure that all of our public schools in this country are top-notch schools, and everybody has, it should be the great equalizer, so people have a chance to succeed, to pull themselves up by the bootstraps in their great public schools. Instead, we have this huge variation, and there are private schools that cost as much as college, you know, that have all kinds of language courses, and it's not really K through 12, the great equalizer, is it?
Not at all. I mean, we see enormous gaps between achievement gaps between racial and ethnic groups and between economic groups, so that the average African American 12th grader is reading at the same level as the average white 8th grader. Now, one of the issues that is doesn't get discussed very much these days, but is very important in equalizing K through 12 education, is the issue of segregation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now you have, it's a one disadvantage to be born into a low-income family in terms of your academic achievement. It is a second, an independent disadvantage to then attend a school where all your classmates are also poor.
Yeah. And on that note, we have to say goodbye, Richard. We're out of time. What a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for writing about this and talking about it.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Richard Kahlenberg, Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation, our guest this hour, talking about a third way for affirmative action. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Sorry we didn't get to all the calls, but we were busy this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have another great hour ahead, so please stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.